The criminal trial of David Pierce and Brant Osborne is scheduled to begin in January 2025. Pierce was charged in December 2021 with sexually assaulting four women and now faces 11 charges, including three additional sexual assault charges, as well as the murders of Christy Giles and Hilda Marcella Cabrales Arzola. The district attorney's office filed the murder and drug charges before taking the case to the grand jury, which returned the indictment December 14, 2022. The prosecution will be led by Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney Catherine Mariano. Pierce will be represented by a defense team made up of Paul Jeffrey Vall, Leslie Ann Boyce, and Jonathan Daniel Evans. Osborne, who was charged with two counts of accessory to murder after the fact, has retained Michael Arden as his attorney. Michael Ansbach, the third man who was with Pierce and Osborne that night, is cooperating with investigators. Let's bring back Josh Ritter, criminal defense attorney and former LA County prosecutor, host of Courtroom Confidential on YouTube. Josh, Pierce and Osborne are being tried together. How closely are their charges tied to one another?
Osborne's charges are independent and they stand by themselves. And they are linked to the crime against Pierce, but they don't rise and fall with how the case plays out against Pierce. In other words, if Pierce is found guilty only of manslaughter, Osborne can still be found guilty of accessory after the fact, and that doesn't change his exposure or criminal culpability. In fact, there is even a scenario where they might feel that they have enough evidence against Osborne for his involvement, but the jurors could be undecided between murder and manslaughter on Pierce and hang on those charges and have to retry him again, even though they've convicted Osborne. So, not to get too much into the weeds, but it is an independent charge and not necessarily married to what happens with Pierce, but it is based upon the crime that Pierce committed, according to the DA's office.
Another interesting point is that the state will combine the sexual assault and murder charges in one trial. Josh, is this going to make it easier or more difficult for the DA's office to prove their case against Pierce?
Again, going back to the idea of being able to prove what was David Pierce's intent and whether or not this was all some sort of horrific accident, I think the DA realizes that a built-in defense to this is that tragically in this country, people die from fentanyl overdose all the time, and that drugs are laced with fentanyl even without people realizing that. And they want to avoid any argument that could be made by the defense that this was somehow just another tragic overdose and that David Pierce should not be held accountable. And the way that they're doing that is show that this isn't an anomaly in this man's life, but that this was a runaway train headed directly for this tragic end, that he had left a trail of women in his wake where he had done things nightmarishly similar to other women in the past. And it ended here, as everyone might have suspected, with a person with these kind of violent, dangerous proclivities towards women. And so it's important for them to understand that this wasn't just a guy having a good time on a night out in Los Angeles, but this is a man who had assaulted women in a remarkably similar fashion many times before, and that he had used drugs to assault them. And that in this instance, when you play with fire, eventually something like this is going to happen. And what ended up happening was the tragic death of Christy and Hilda.
We don't know who will be testifying until they actually take the stand, but witnesses who already testified to the grand jury include actor David Marietta, who could be one of the key witnesses after Brant Osborne told him about the night Christy and Hilda were killed, LAPD detective Jonathan Vanderlei, as well as a security guard from the hospital in Culver City where Christy was dropped off. There were also seven Jane Does who testified to the grand jury. Prosecutors tell Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood that more victims are expected to testify. The charges against Pierce include three separate counts of forcible rape, one count each of sodomy by use of force, and rape of unconscious or asleep person, and two counts of sexual penetration by use of force. Let's bring back Trinka Parada, retired narcotics detective after 25 years with the Los Angeles Police Department, now president of the Project GHB board, and a renowned expert on drug-facilitated sexual assaults. Trinka, you've investigated a number of sexual predators. What does the timeline of Pierce's charges tell you, and the pattern of very similar accusations dating back to 2007?
Well, the whole history of this guy, again, you've got cases that we'll probably never hear about, people that have gone on in their lives and may not even have come forward now. But it sounds like an escalation and certainly a long-term pattern of the headed to where it ended, unfortunately, tragically. It's important to document all that they can. Judges may or may not allow some of the prior cases. A lot of times we aren't allowed to introduce prior activity, even though it's clearly relevant and it follows the same pattern. But I think it's important when judges do allow it, it's important to show the growth of the person's conduct that resulted then in this case to death. That makes him a pretty heartless serial predator. So I'm not surprised at his string of cases, and I'm sure there's more, and it appears to be an escalation of them, or he's involved other people, knowing what was going on, other people involved in helping cover it up. And I think that shows a growing pattern of misconduct and criminality. So hopefully that will be well documented and well entered and allowed. So no surprise in the long term. It's just so tragic that it took so long to really nail this guy down and stop his spree.
Now, let's not forget, Pierce is also facing two felony drug charges for providing controlled substance fentanyl. We do know he met Christy and Hilda at the warehouse party, and multiple witnesses told police they observed Pierce giving both women cocaine, including Ansbach, who was with them. During his testimony, Ansbach also revealed the women had their own supply of ketamine, and we know from Christy and Hilda's friend Dohi that they had also done cocaine earlier in the evening at the art gallery. That could be challenging for the prosecution to prove the drugs Pierce gave them were the ones that caused their death, not their own drugs, and that Pierce did so knowingly. Josh, will that be difficult for the DA to prove?
The defense is obviously going to focus much of their attention on the idea that Christy and Hilda were willingly taking drugs themselves that evening. This is not an instance of where somebody slipped something into their drink at a bar unaware to them. They were taking cocaine. They had apparently been in possession of their own narcotics that they were willingly taking that evening. There's even evidence that they were, their text communications between the two of them talking about consuming drugs. And the defense is going to, I imagine, spend a large part of their attention and time focusing on how they were taking drugs. They were taking drugs from different sources. They may have been handed drugs by different individuals other than David Pierce that evening. And that, unfortunately, we live in a time where sometimes you can just get a hot dose, and that means that a person ends up dead, and it had nothing to do with David Pierce. And that is why his history is so important. And bringing in these other assaults from even years ago, where he had ployed women with drugs, is so important to understand that, no, this was no accident. The trouble only arose after they met David Pierce, and only after they made the tragic decision to go back to his apartment, and he started to give them further drugs, and he started to give them cocktails mixed likely with other narcotics that were, I think we can all assume the prosecution's argument is going to be those narcotics were intended to render them unconscious so that he could sexually assault them. And even his behavior afterwards, realizing that the drugs were something that he needed to cover up, all of that becomes so much more important. And it's not going to be a small task for the prosecution. It will be an undertaking to convince jurors beyond a reasonable doubt that, no, this is not a tragic accident, that, no, the drugs that killed these two women did not come from a different source, but that it is this man, based upon what we know about him, based upon his history, based upon his conduct that evening, that led to their deaths.
Actions speak louder than words. And one of the things that could potentially be an issue is when once the girls were start experiencing issues, why wasn't 911 called? Why weren't they immediately taken to the hospital? We know both women were conscious at 5:40 a.m. from Ann's box cell phone video, just minutes after they shared texts about wanting to leave the apartment. We know after that, an Uber showed up but didn't pick up the girls, and they spent the next 11 hours inside the apartment, during which neighbors heard a woman screaming in pain and moaning on and off during the hours of 10:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. From that point, Pierce and Osborne's actions could play a central role in the trial. Both men were allegedly seen on surveillance footage carrying Christy and Hilda's body to the car. They were also seen covering their faces, and hospital staff also confirmed that masked men had dropped off the girls in a car with license plates removed. Josh, from a legal perspective, how does removing the license plates and covering up their faces reflect on the suspects?
A large part of the prosecution's case is going to be about what we call consciousness of guilt evidence, meaning everything that the defendants did afterwards that show that they knew what they had done was something wrong, that they had a consciousness of their own guilt and were trying to cover up their steps. Had this been a tragic overdose, anyone would expect them to call 911 at the first sign of trouble and try to get assistance for these women and try to get them to a hospital as quickly as they can and try to save their lives. But instead of doing that, David Pierce took steps specifically to protect himself and therefore likely caused these women to die by his failure to act quickly and by his attempts to cover up what he had done. And what I'm talking about specifically is driving them to two separate hospitals at different times with a car that did not have a license plate, covering their faces with masks. All of this is so that they are not captured. At no point are they taking any steps to save these women. At no point does it appear as though they cared about the lives of these two women. Instead, David Pierce cared only about himself and trying to evade capture. And that consciousness of guilt evidence will play a significant role in this trial.
There is also evidence that Pierce and Osborne went even further than that to cover their tracks, allegedly coming up with a story that the girls wandered onto their property, keeping and destroying Hilda's cell phone, and searching for non-extradition countries or places to disappear, according to the LAPD. One potential tricky aspect of the trial will be reviewing the autopsies and making sense of the toxicology results for both women, which show drugs in their system and some evidence of what could be interpreted as foul play. Going back to Dr. Jay Vargas, associate professor at California State University in Los Angeles. Doctor, you reviewed both autopsies. How can the autopsy and the toxicology results help or hurt the investigation into whether or not David Pierce is responsible for the deaths of Christie and Hilda?
So I'm not a lawyer. Of course, I am not a legal expert, but my sort of view of this case is that, and then again, I'm not privy to all of the sort of, I guess, all the testimony that may have already been given on observing these two women that evening ingesting drugs. It sounded like to me the way the experts that I did read said that there was observations of them, you know, recreationally using drugs at the bar or maybe this rave that they went to. So that's a point in time where, you know, drugs and a drug laced with fentanyl, in my opinion, could have been administered at that point. And then certainly later on when these two women are at this individual's residence, that, of course, is another point in time for sort of the drugs to be administered. So either way, what will be most difficult in this case is like motive, like, you know, or intent. Is somebody intending to kill these individuals knowingly, or if it was, you know, sort of involuntary, right? And so to me, in this case, I feel like what will likely be an outcome would be something like involuntary manslaughter. I mean, I think they're certainly liable for what happened, especially if they're providing drugs for these two women. And, you know, if they knew that the drugs were laced with fentanyl and that was something that they were going for, then I think, you know, it's possible to even get to like a second degree murder charge. But it's more likely to me that they probably didn't understand and they didn't really know that the drugs were laced with fentanyl. And so that to me would be something that would be harder for someone to prove, I guess, would be we knew the drugs had fentanyl in it. I mean, that would go one way. If they didn't know the drugs that they were abusing had fentanyl, then I think it could go, you know, another way.
How big of a factor is time when it comes to cases like this and in cases of an overdose?
If we sort of assume that, you know, fentanyl was the main driver here, fentanyl is a extremely potent opioid medication. It's used primarily for, you know, people with extreme pain. And the fact that it's been now produced globally and it's manufactured clandestinely, sort of produced and brought into the country various ways, and then finding its way into all sorts of drugs. Its onset's going to happen within once it's ingested. And again, this all really has to do with dose, right? I mean, if small amounts might be tolerated longer, but you know, if a large amount of fentanyl comes on board, you would imagine that somebody would be succumbing to the effects of that, and then, you know, pretty quickly would start to, you know, fentanyl does have a rapid onset. It's supposed to, right? It's a medication used for pain management, and particularly chronic, you know, cancer pain, like really excruciating pain. So this drug is going to work relatively quickly. And then if too much is on board, then that sort of drug effect that, you know, somebody might be going for, that's going to sort of dissipate and then go towards this. It's basically respiratory depression. So that's what ends up killing people when they have too much of the opioid on board, the fentanyl. And so again, it's hard to really put a timeline on it. You know, it's possible both of these women could have been taking, if they were getting them maybe from the same person all night, it's possible that they sort of may have been building up this drug level. At the same time, it's possible that maybe they both got it the largest dose later on in the night. It's hard to really put that timing on it. But what is for sure is that once these observations of labored shallow breathing and the person's incapacitated at that point, you really just need that person to get assistance right away. And of course, you know, we need to breathe to live. And so if breathing gets to the point where obviously we're not going to be able to have a great outcome for those individuals. And so, you know, waiting around, driving them around, dropping them off at hospitals and stuff like that was just not obviously going to be, in my opinion, the best outcome because of the time that's passing. And it's very unfortunate. And I just think, like, what could have happened if these individuals just, you know, saw that, you know, hey, this didn't work out the way we wanted. You know, obviously they're sort of predatory and they're trying to take advantage of these two women. But, you know, at some point they must have realized that they had something is wrong here. If they just would have, you know, called, you know, 911, and it is possible that they could have survived if they got sort of an intervention of naloxone or Narcan.
In the grand jury proceedings, the prosecution also went through the results of the SART sexual assault exams performed on both Christy and Hilda, as well as Jane Doe 1 and 5. Robert Broderick, a criminalist with LAPD who tested the sexual assault kit performed on Christy Giles, said male DNA was found on the vaginal swabs, external genitalia, neck, breast, and inner thighs. The mix contained too much female DNA, so YSTR testing was done. Let's welcome Dr. Monty Miller, Director of Forensic DNA Experts and a specialist in sexual assaults and murder investigations. Doctor, what is YSTR testing and why was it done in this case?
So typically, they use what's called autosomal DNA testing. And, you know, everybody has 46 chromosomes. And this particular test, the autosomal DNA testing, attempts to collect information from most of those chromosomes. And so you get a wide variety of information. You have approximately 50 data points that you can calculate. And it's very informative and it's very specific. The YSTR testing allows them to look for male DNA when there's a lot of female DNA. So if you have about inside the vagina, for example, there's an enormous amount of female DNA, and sometimes it's just hard to find the male DNA. It's like a drop of blue paint in a bucket of pink paint. You just don't see that one drop. So the YSTR testing allows us to look just for that blue drop, just for the male DNA. And it's not as specific to single individuals, but it does allow us to find a family male tree that the DNA came from, and it does help us identify people when there's a lot of female DNA and very little male DNA.
The blood was taken from Pierce, Osborne, and Ansbach, then tested against the DNA evidence found on Christy for a potential match. Broderick said when the results came back, the DNA from samples from the inner thigh and external genitalia matched the profile of David Pierce and excluded Osborne and Ansbach. Dr. Miller, what can you tell us about the mix of Pierce's DNA found in the samples from Christie's sexual assault exam?
Overall, it's clear that his DNA is present in and on Christy Giles, in and around her, vagina and other areas. There's an indication that might be semen, though that wasn't confirmed. On Hilda Cabrales, you know, his DNA is found on both her left and right fingernails. There's male DNA on Christy Giles on her vaginal sample, anal sample, external sample, neck, breasts, and inner thighs. There is DNA from David Pierce in Jane Doe's vagina, Jane Doe number 5. There is DNA from David Pierce on Jane Doe's face and neck. And so we know his DNA overall is on all of these women. And with the exception of Jane Doe number 1, well, and even Hilda Marcella, it's on Jane Doe number 1 and in Hilda Marcella, it's not in an intimate region, whereas on Christy Giles and Jane Doe number 5, it's clearly in an intimate region. So he's had some interaction with all of these people, and that much is known and that much is clear. But none of this really establishes that he killed anybody or did anything else. He could have simply had sex with Christy Giles and had some, you know, physical interaction with Hilda Marcella. Jane Doe number 5, you know, it looks like he probably had sex with her. And Jane Doe number 1, his DNA is on her face and neck. So overall, he's been in contact with these women, but this in and of itself doesn't tell the story. It just places him in places and taking actions that are clear and unmistakable in some cases, but it really doesn't tell us the context of those things.
But that wasn't all. A sexual assault exam was also performed on Hilda while she was still in hospital, though it wasn't done until 3 days after she was dropped off on November 16th. Carolyn Clark, another criminalist with the LA County, found a small, approximately 5 millimeter abrasion in Hilda's vagina, as well as another small abrasion to her lower abdomen. For Hilda, only fingernail swabs provided enough DNA for analysis. Now, this could be due to the extensive cleaning procedures that she underwent during her time in the hospital, and thus the only DNA that was available were in her fingernails. The DNA mixture found underneath both Hilda's fingernails matched two profiles, Hilda and David Pierce. Now, this information came out during the grand jury proceedings. We know that fingernail DNA is often collected in sexual assault cases as it can be an indicator of a struggle or defensive wounds. But we also know that Hilda was close to Pierce that night, and Michael Ansbach testified that the two had been making out earlier in the night at the warehouse party. Dr. Miller, what are your thoughts about Pierce's DNA being found underneath Hilda's fingernails, and what does that tell us?
Well, the numbers tell me that they've identified his DNA for certain on the left and right fingernails. They know that's his DNA. So that's one thing. The second thing is that, you know, when you're having close, intimate contact with somebody, there can be things like massaging. There can be things like light scratching and things of that nature that could get DNA into those places. You know, you could lick someone's finger, for example. And, you know, you would get a significant amount of your saliva and DNA underneath their fingernails. You could penetrate a woman's vagina, for example, and get an enormous amount of her DNA underneath your fingernails. So there are other ways to get DNA underneath your fingernails. But one of them is scratching. One of them is that you could have a struggle and you could scratch somebody. And so that's what they're looking for. They're looking to make sure, to confirm that his DNA is on her body. So we don't know for sure how the DNA got underneath her fingernails. That's all speculation. Scratching and certainly some sort of physical interaction happened between them, but we don't know that that happened during a non-consensual act or anything that was violent or she was protecting herself. That's all speculation. Although those are all good ways to get DNA underneath the fingernails, there are lots of ways and reasons, although, you know, it does require some sort of touching and that kind of thing. The other thing that comes into consideration is the length of the fingernails. Just because your fingertips and the edge of your fingernails can touch somebody better than if you have really long fingernails. And so it's a little different to get your DNA underneath someone's fingernails if they're long than if they're short. And so we don't know for sure what happened when DNA is underneath the fingernails, but it does tell us that there's DNA there. You can identify the person, and everything else becomes speculation.
How common are injuries like abrasions to the vagina and abdomen in sexual assault cases?
Well, I think that it's hard to really tell with sexual assault. And I'm not a medical doctor, and I don't try to get too much into the injuries and what they are and what they mean. But I can tell you this from hearing lots of sexual assault nursing examiners talk and having spoken with many of them, that you can have no findings whatsoever. And it's very, very common to have no findings, even when a sexual assault has occurred. And any two people that have sex, there's always going to be at least some micro abrasions that can be identified. Some people have, rougher consensual sex than other people. So it's very common to have no findings in a sexual assault nursing examination, even when a sexual assault has occurred. And it's very common to have findings and red spots and micro abrasions, even during consensual sexual contact. So those things, unless they're really obvious and there's some real tears and some serious damage, you really can't tell whether that's consensual sex or non-consensual sex occurred because of small and light injuries and redness and small abrasions.
It's also worth noting that Pierce has not been charged with sexual assault relating to either Christy or Hilda, regardless of the DNA results. Josh, if Pierce isn't charged with sexual assault of Christy or Hilda, how does their DNA results impact the case? Why would the prosecution use this evidence?
The significance of the evidence as it relates to any sexual assault or attempted sexual assault is it's part of the overall pattern of conduct of Pierce. The DA's theory is not so much that he premeditated these murders, that he intended to cause their deaths, but that he was playing with fire, and that over the course of his conduct, which is demonstrated by all of the prior allegations of sexual assault, and his conduct on that evening, which included evidence circumstantially that he was at least attempting to or perhaps did participate in a sexual assault that evening, and that the use of drugs was to help him facilitate that, that this was a tragedy waiting to happen. And so therefore, he can be held responsible for their murders because this isn't some accident. This isn't some anomaly. This isn't a one-time event that took place in his life, but he had been playing with this dangerous situation for so long that it was inevitable that it would end up with this type of tragedy that we're dealing with now in the death of these two young women.
It also makes you wonder about other potential victims. Many of the Jane Does in this case weren't able to come forward until Pierce was already arrested. Why was that? Many describe having memory issues or Pierce threatening them after being assaulted by him. The evidence shows a consistent pattern of behavior, and many of the experts have described what Pierce is accused of as predatory behavior. And what else can we learn from this? How do we protect people we love? Our daughters, our wives, our sisters, our best friends, from predators, especially in these types of environments. What can change about how cases like this are prosecuted? What type of lessons does this case teach us about consent? What can we change about empowering women to come forward to tell their story? How do we make sure the people who prey on these women are put in jail? How do we make sure that these women get justice?
Before we wrap up our final pretrial episode, now let's hear from the families of Christy and Hilda again and what kind of impact this case has had on them.
Dusty, what has this experience been like for you from the beginning of the investigation to the arrest, the DA not charging Pierce and Osborne initially, and now finally getting to the trial? Can you take us through what this process has been like?
I would like to ask for anybody that has any sympathy for us, go to our GoFundMe account and help with the travel expenses of us going and staying the length of the trial. Right now, we are looking at one complete month, and at the same time, her, Leslie, Wayne, her dad, has had a bad accident. And he's been off work, and he will be off work without leave. And if they would generously give, it's all for Christy's travel. And we would greatly appreciate any support or any fundraising idea.
For our listeners, you can find the link to the GoFundMe in the podcast description for this episode or on our website, onceuponacrimeinhollywood.com. Let's also welcome back Jan Siliers, Christy's husband. Jan, what kind of impact has this had on your life?
You know, it's obviously she was the love of my life. I miss her every day. And I've kind of, since the beginning of her passing, it kind of felt like I'd taken like a left turn in the correct universal timeline, and I've been living in the Twilight Zone pretty much, in a place where she doesn't exist, which is a much less happy place to be, I think. She was a joy to my life. And I wish things had obviously not gone down that road, obviously. But yeah, for myself personally, I find that in order to get out of my own head and sort of come to terms with the trauma about, you know, losing Christy was, I went traveling pretty much for a full year. Went all the way through South America, a bunch of places in Europe, Southeast Asia, sort of experiencing new things and seeing new things and being present with myself, was the best way to sort of process that trauma for myself. But yeah, throughout that process, I was always in touch with her detectives, always in touch with her family. It's been tough. I miss her every day.
And now Hilda's mother, Dr. Arzola Plasencia. Do you have anything else you want to say?
This is a life-changing situation. It will never, ever be the same it was. And nothing can fill that space that she left. But as already Phil told you, Fernanda told you, we prefer to remember like a very loving person, like a pushing person, you know, to try to, you can do it, come on. And the light of our lives. For me, I'm proud of her, and I'm always will be proud of her, always. This is a life lesson. It will change. It already has, and it still will change many lives. And we have the ability to choose what we have, what we want, sorry, to choose. I when I think about it, you know, sometimes when I'm seeing the news, I see every day people dies, but when the people who die is someone near to you, obviously it changed your life, it changed the situation, it changed everything. And as Fer, my daughter, already said, nothing will bring them back again. Nothing. But we can honor their lives, their legacy, living the best we can, trying to see life in a different way. And for me, in my opinion, it's something very personal. I was kind of shocked in a good way. Obviously, this is a tragedy, and nobody can deny it. And they were a lot of angels. That's what I'm trying to say to you. People that I never ever thought they were trying to come to us to help us. I'm really, really, really thankful with all of them in the hospital. I was trying to say thank you with a big words. Thank you to all those who were kind to us, that understood the situation. They were so human. They were so kind. Not everybody, but mostly. And I have no words to say thank you. The social worker, I told you, the doctor, I unfortunately can't remember her name, but you have no idea how the impact she had on my life. And obviously all the situation had an impact on my life. I tried to make it worth, you know, because I'm still working with patients. Now I know how it feels to be a family with a patient that is in the hospital, and I try to have some empathy to these people, you know, because I already been over there. And sometimes we just keep our eyes in bad things like this, because we can't deny this is a crime, but we can also see good things, and good things happened, and they are still happening, and they will happen. And we have to be aware of them. And for me, I'm really thankful, as I already told you, and mostly with God, because He never, ever, ever left me alone. And I'm sorry for saying this, but I can't deny it. You know, for me, this is so a huge reality that I can't deny it. And I don't know if we have the right things, but we didn't decide to disconnect her. I never, ever will choose that. The things were so bad for her and for health that that the doctor said that she has no more cerebral activity. So she donated her organs, and we didn't knew what happened with them. They said that someday we'll be able to get in touch with those who received her kidneys or her liver. They didn't spoke with us anymore. Even we left the emails, the phones, they didn't told us what happened with them. And I like to know someday that we made the right decision to help other people even this tragedy.
Thank you for sharing. I know this must be very difficult. Thank you for sharing your experience with our listeners.
I also want to ask Hilda's close friend, Fernanda Canasani. How are you and others close to Hilda remembering her?
I speak for myself, but also I guess I can say it for my friends. We are, and as Marce's mother say, without her is never the same. Even if we are together with Tomas and we are having a good time thinking of the funny things we lived with her and all the beautiful things we memories we have with her, because we all, of course, we decide to remember her as we knew her and not because what happened to her. And for us, I guess it's hard to do, but it's two different things. And we decide to focus on the good memories, on the good things she left us. And I guess since now, for me, everyone, we are trying to live our lives to honor her. And to we always, I don't know, with my friends, we're always saying, like, what would Marce do in this situation? And we laugh because it's everything, like, you do it or you don't do anything. So it's really empowering to think of her like she made it, she did what she wanted, she went to LA and she lived the life she wanted. Maybe it was not for a long time, maybe it ended in a situation where every of us got shocked and it changed the lives of everyone. But yeah, we try and honor her, not just by gathering with each other and talking about her and the memories we have, but also by living our own lives the way she would live her own and the way she will, I don't know, wanted us to live our lives. So, yes, for me, it's, I keep her with me in my heart everywhere I go, because I don't know, I guess I decide to think that she came to my life to give me a lesson in life, to see life as it is. It's not always beautiful, but you can choose to see the beautiful things, you know. So I choose always to remember her as a beautiful person. She always was with me and with all her friends. And yes, for me, if this didn't happen, I guess my life would be so different. In many ways, of course, but it's been the most difficult thing. But at the same time, I feel really close to her each time I try to turn the pain to something beautiful. So because I know this is what she will do or she wanted me to do. So little actions in my day like this make me feel more close to her each time. So yeah, I don't know. For me, she came to give us a hard lesson, but at the same time, I could say beautiful too, because I don't know, we choose to see the beautiful things in this horrible situation. So
what you said is very inspiring. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm so sorry to hear what you've gone through and what you continue to go through because of what happened. And life sometimes gives you lessons. And some are harder than others. But thank you for showing some light. Thank you for sharing that we must turn pain into something beautiful. And know that she will never be forgotten.
And we'll give the last word to Hilda's sister, Fernanda. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
I think from my side, I just wanted to add, like, I know we already talked about it, but I think for us, it's very clear that what happened that night was a crime, and everyone involved, not just Pierce, is responsible for taking the lives of both my sister and Christy. As well, we already mentioned, besides like drugging them, if they just had taken them to the hospital, called 911, done something to help, things might have been different. And yeah, like that, the choice of not doing it was what cost the life of my sister and Christy. And, you know, yeah, they were both so young with so much ahead of them, dreams, futures, everything was stolen. And it was also just not their futures that was taken from us. It was also our future with them too. And yeah, our lives will never be the same without my sister. Nothing will bring her back, but we just want justice. We want justice to be brought in this case.
Our hearts go out to the victims and to the families and friends and loved ones of Christy Hilda and the other women who are bravely testifying in this case. David Pierce remains innocent of all charges until proven guilty in a court of law. Brant Osborne is also innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. The trial is set for January 2025. We'll be following the case and we'll provide an update once it wraps up. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Remember, you can get all of our shows and information about our other podcasts, including The Hollywood Ripper and The Ronnie Chasen Story, at our website, onceuponacrimeinhollywood.com. I'm Kelly Hyman, and this is Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood, Girls Night Out.